Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Herald podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes. To keep in touch with us, use our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, which are all at Q and Review. That's Q&Review, or get in touch via information@qandreview.com. That's information@QandReview.com. Please like and share our podcasts and give us any constructive feedback.
Recorded from the Herald on the 30th of June 2021. From the sports section, Celtic handed Odson Edward boost as Leicester snap up RB Salzburg striker to end pursuit, by Mark Hendry. Leicester City's interest in Odson Edward seems to be over after the Foxes signed RB Salzburg ace Patson Daka. Daka, 22, is a proven goalscorer with a terrific record for the Austrian outfit, with 29 goals from 36 appearances last season alone. That took his tally to 59 and 103 over 4 years. Brendan Rodgers, the Leicester boss, has been keen to bolster his attacking options and had been keeping tabs on Edward, a player he brought to Parkhead during his time as Celtic manager back in 2018. Celts have been bracing themselves for a bid for Edward, whose deal expires next summer, but the Premier League side looked to be finished with their pursuit after making their signing. Meanwhile, the Frenchman was today pictured back in training at Lennoxton under the watchful eye of Ange Postecoglou. The new Hoops head coach revealed recently that he would be having a chat with this key striker with the view to trying to entice him to stay amid constant transfer speculation. That article was by Mark Hendry. Recorded from the Herald on the 30th of June 2021. From the sports section, ex-Celtic star Tommy Johnson emerges as frontrunner for Aberdeen head of recruitment role, by Mark Hendry. Tommy Johnson is a frontrunner to become Aberdeen's new head of recruitment, according to reports. The former Celtic attacker has been working as a headhunter. Dons have been on the hunt for a new recruiter to work alongside new manager Stephen Glass and his backroom staff. A new sporting director at Pittodrie, Stephen Gunn, has been tasked with the role of bringing in a new head of recruitment, which the Daily Mail claim is a role Johnson could fit. Johnson, 50, currently works in the same position at Blackpool in England's Championship, but could be tempted north of the border to the Granite City. The retired striker had the opportunity last season to work alongside former teammate Henrik Larsson at Southend, with the Swede hoping to take his pal with him into the management position. But Johnson snubbed the chance at the 11th hour, ruining Larsson's chance at the job, though he landed on his feet as Ronald Koeman's assistant boss at Barcelona. That article was by Mark Hendry.
Herald Scotland, recorded on Wednesday, 30th of June 2021. Arts and Entertainments. Climate Change and Conspiracy, paperbacks by Diane Cook, Andrew Scott and Jeff Chaun, by Alistair Mabbitt. The New Wilderness, Diane Cook, One World, £8.99. In a plotted future, Bea takes part in an experiment to save her daughter Agnes from the toxicity of the city. She's one of 20 volunteers selected to go to a nature reserve and become nomadic hunter-gatherers to see if humans can live in nature without destroying it. But Bea isn't cut out for that way of life and packs it in to return to the city, leaving Agnes behind. The complicated dynamic between mother and daughter is at the heart of the book, as Agnes grows up and considers becoming a mother herself. The appearance of this novel in the Booker long list was taken as a sign that climate fiction might be going mainstream, and the world building around the Bea-Agnes relationship is fascinating and frequently uncomfortable, from the painful evolution of a new society to Cook's unsentimental take on the wilderness and the alien quality of a landscape altered by climate change. Sovereign Cause, Andrew Scott, Twa Corbies, £8.99. The fourth of Scott's Willie Morton novels finds the Edinburgh-based journalist investigating the 1985 death of civil servant Matthew McConacher, who died 19 days after publishing a report showing Scotland's economy to be the most stable in the UK. The 30-year period has elapsed, but the report hasn't been declassified. Morton's efforts to find out why are noticed by the all-powerful NSS, the top level of the security services, and the consequences are soon felt by Morton and his Catalan intern, Yesabit. Scott clearly isn't worried that letting his own political sympathies creep into the text will get in the way of a gripping story. He's latched on to the aspects of 21st century Scotland that makes it a fertile setting for a paranoid conspiracy thriller, and cleverly constructed a plot that triggers associations with both the McCrone Report and Willie McRae's mysterious death, resonances that make it feel incredibly tense. Hashtag good guy with a gun, Jeff Chaun, sagging meniscus, £15.99. Disgraced teacher Scott Bonneville is hailed as a hero when he prevents a mass shooting in a pizza parlour by shooting the would-be killer. What people don't know is that Bonneville had gone there armed with an agenda of his own, fired up by QAnon-style conspiracy theories. Set around the election of Donald Trump in 2016, John's novel returns to the pizza parlour shooting several times to examine the characters who were in the vicinity, like Blake, who reinvented himself as an alpha male after finding his mother having sex with his teacher, Bonneville. John takes us into the dark heart of toxic masculinity, fake news, radicalisation, and the culture that social media has shaped from them. Thoughtful but fast-moving and laced with biting wit, it's an offbeat satire on the cultish, fragmented realities that have come to define the USA, particularly the young men swept up by incel culture. By Alistair Mabbitt, Herald Scotland, recorded on Wednesday, 30th of June, 2021. Arts and Entertainments. Orwell Prize. The Brave Writers Taking on the Tyrants and Falling in Orwell's Footsteps. By Rosemary Goring, columnist. In 1946, George Orwell wrote an essay in which he outlined the four main reasons for writing. One was egoism, another aesthetic enthusiasm, the third was a historical impulse, the desire to find out true facts and store them up for the use of posterity. This was closely linked to the fourth, political purpose, which he described as the desire to push the world in a certain direction, to alter other people's idea of the kind of society that they should strive for. Sadly, the totalitarianism and dictatorships Orwell railed against are with us still, even if in different shape. In a jingle he dashed off to prod himself into action, he wrote, "I wasn't born for an age like this. Was Smith? Was Jones? Were you?" It was a direct challenge to writers to make a stand, to heed their consciences, avoid fence-sitting and choose a side. His words have a particular resonance for me this week after learning that the editor for whom I wrote at Apple Daily, Hong Kong's pro-democracy paper, has been arrested. His detention at Hong Kong Airport follows the arrest of Apple Daily's owner, Jimmy Lai, and more recently of six other senior figures. All are accused of colluding with foreign forces. After its assets were frozen last week, the paper had no alternative but to close. As the Chinese authorities crush any dissent, the situation in Hong Kong is bleak for anyone whose business is to report and comment on what they see. Following new national security laws, freedom of speech is becoming a distant dream, the cost of speaking out too dangerous. What will happen to the imprisoned Apple Daily staff, no one knows. Although it will bring little comfort to them or their families, you can be sure that one day the full story of Apple Daily and its extraordinarily courageous journalists will be told. In the meantime, I have discovered as a judge for the 2021 Orwell Prize for Political Writing just how many writers are putting into practice Orwell's injunction and living up to his ideals of exposing lies and uncovering the truth. The Orwell Foundation runs several prizes whose winners were announced on June 25, Orwell's birthday, as well as Political Writing, won by Joshua Yaffa for Between Two Fires, of which more later. There is a category for political fiction, which was won by Ali Smith for her novel Summer, one for journalism, and one for Exposing Britain's Social Evils. Brackets details on the Orwell Foundation website, close brackets. November saw the start of what I look back on as my winter of discontent. Boxes of books were delivered as if Christmas had come early, piled in towers in the sitting room to provide a supplementary coffee table. And much caffeine was consumed as I and my fellow judges began to work our way through a selection winnowed from an original list of around 250 titles. The discontent was not mine, I should add, but the subject matter of these books, they range from homelessness in the UK and our beleaguered care system, to Brexit, Trump's America and the state of Europe. There are biographies of totemic figures such as Toussaint Louverture and JFK and social and political histories. There was an undercover report into far-right extremism, a memoir manifesto of British farming, and correctives to the colonial views of history and the all-white narrative of Europe. Looking up at the end of a chapter to see snow falling on bare-branched trees was a jolt. After absorbing so much anguish, exploitation, corruption and power-mongering, it felt unreal to be faced with a tranquil scene. Not everything was misery, though, and while some books were more compelling than others, almost everything was interesting. It was like being plunged into an open university course. I would resurface each day with my mind broadened and some of the woeful gaps in my knowledge plugged. Immediately striking was the bravery of some of the finest writers. Not everyone is called to be a foreign correspondent like Christina Lamb, but her clear-eyed, harrowing account, Our Bodies, Their Battlefield, of women raped as a tactic of war, will remain with me forever. So too Barbara Demick's undercover reporting of Tibet's oppressed and exiled citizens, Eat the Buddha. With so many books, how could four judges ever hope to agree? Our chair, Professor Anand Menon of King's College London, kept a wise hand in the tiller as the rest of us, Angela Siney, a broadcaster and journalist, and Professor Richard Aitkins of the University of Oxford, picked our way through this library. It's a measure of the outstanding quality of Joshua Yaffa's writing that, despite our diverse interests and outlooks and the strength of the competition, his book emerged as the clear winner. Yaffa is a correspondent for The New Yorker in Moscow, and Between Two Fires depicts a selection of contemporary Russians who have learned to negotiate the minefield of the repressive and quixotic Putin state to achieve their ambitions. It is a masterly portrait of compromise and cunning, and what walking this high wire does to an individual and to the body politic. It's also beautifully written with attitude and humour. Visiting Oleg Zubkov, who runs a safari park in Crimea, Yaffa watches in horror as the zookeeper heads for the lions, smothering a 400-pound lion with the sort of hug you give a Labrador, rubbing his cheek against the lion's and giving its nose a soft poke with his finger. When another growls, he waves his rubber slipper at it, which seems to do the trick. Zubkov's crazy confidence and courage could stand as a metaphor for the precarious line trodden by all the larger-than-life personalities in this work. It also sums up anyone anywhere in the world who dares to confront an oppressive regime. Describing his literary ambition in the same essay, Orwell wrote, "What I've most wanted to do throughout the past 10 years is to make political writing into an art." It is in part thanks to him that so many, like Yaffa and the other Orwell Prize contenders, are inspired to do the same. Our columns are a platform for writers to express their opinions. They do not necessarily represent the views of the Herald. By Rosemary Goring.
The Herald, Thursday the 1st of July 2021. News. Sir David Murray hands over control of family business. This article is by Scott Wright. Former Rangers owner Sir David Murray has passed ownership of his family business onto his sons. Murray Capital Group, which has interests in metals, property and wine, has been taken over by Sir David's sons, David and Keith, under a planned transition of ownership. The brothers acquired the share capital of the company for an undisclosed sum in March. Sir David, who sold Rangers to Craig White in a controversial deal a decade ago, remains chairman of the group. The announcement came as Murray Capital reported a pre-tax loss of £11.6 million for an extended 18-month accounting period ending June the 30th, 2020. Murray Capital cited the impact of exceptional costs relating to the restructure of its metals business, the impairment of investments because of COVID-19, and trading losses within portfolio companies. However, it declared that it expects a return to strong profitability this year. Sir David said, "Running a family business presents many challenges, but it allows you to always think about long-term benefits rather than short-term issues. Being able to transition the ownership successfully to the next generation has been in our plan for many years, I am delighted that we have now achieved this successfully, with David focused on the Murray Capital Group and Keith on our wine business. I am pleased to remain as chairman, with an active interest in our core steel business in particular, and a small continuing equity stake. I have been through many ups and downs over the last 50 years in business, as anyone willing to bear risk inevitably does, but I retain great expectations and energy for the next phase. I have complete confidence in my sons, who are willing and able, and for the businesses they now own and lead. This article is by Scott Wright.
Recorded from the Herald on the 1st of July 2021, from the Sports section, Lee Griffith pens new Celtic contract as club trigger 1 year extension, by Mark Hendry. Lee Griffith has signed a 1 year extension to keep him at Celtic. The striker, 30, had been rumoured to be leaving after appearing to remove all links to the club from his social media accounts this week. However, after discussions with new head coach Ange Postecoglou, the hitman has re-signed and will remain after the club took up their option of a 1 year extension. I am delighted to extend my time at the club, he told the club website. Celtic is a club I love and want to do all I can to play my part again in bringing success to our supporters. I'm looking forward to the season ahead and working with the new gaffer and the rest of the lads. It's an exciting time for the club and I wanted to be part of the club's future. I'll be doing everything I can to help us get back to where we all want to be. Celtic boss Postecoglou added, I'm really pleased to keep Lee with us for another season at least. I have had very positive conversations with Lee, and he clearly understands my expectations, and more importantly, the club's. Lee has already proven himself as one of the top strikers in Scotland, and I look forward to working with him so that we can bring success to Celtic Football Club. That article was by Mark Hendry.
Herald Scotland recorded on Thursday, 1st of July 2021. Arts and Entertainments. Billy Connolly does. Scottish comedian confirms plans for new TV series. By Jack Aitchison, live editor, The Herald. Sir Billy Connolly is to look back at his 5 decades of stand-up in a new series for Gold. Billy Connolly Does will see the Scottish comic reflect on how his views on life have and have not changed since he started out in the 1960s. Each of the 5 episodes will focus on different topic: work, love and marriage, sex, travel and childhood and parenthood, and will be shot around the Florida home he shares with his wife Pamela Stevenson. Sir Billy, affectionately known as the Biggin, was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2013 and retired from live performances 5 years later. The 78-year-old said, I'm really looking forward to sharing a few of my favourite moments from over the years. It's been brilliant and I hope you'll come along for the ride. The series, which comes from Moonshine Features, was commissioned for UK TV by Ian Coyle, head of comedy entertainment, and ordered by Gerald Casey, channel director for Gold. Coyle said, so this is a career highlight, working with one of, if not the greatest comedians of all time. I feel incredibly privileged that Billy and his family have given us access, not only to his incredible archive, but also to their everyday lives. Casey added, we're thrilled to welcome the legendary Billy Connolly to Gold. Moonshine Features have secured incredible access for this series, and we can't wait to hear all of the hilarious and at times ridiculous life lessons from one of the all-time greats. Moonshine series director Mike Riley said, I've been lucky enough to have worked with Billy for some time now, and the one thing that never ceases to amaze me is how easy he makes it for everyone to be in his company, how the laughter, the perils of wisdom and the shaggy dog tales never seem to stop. To have the opportunity to show all of that while trawling through a treasure trove of amazing comedy is just a dream come true. Sir Billy, who was a welder in his home city of Glasgow before becoming an entertainer, is to publish an autobiography called Windswept and Interesting in the Autumn by Jack Aitchison. Herald Scotland recorded on Thursday, 1st of July 2021. Arts and Entertainments. Boo Patterson, John Mackey, Sarah Ogilvie and Greg Buchanan. Scottish authors and illustrators making headlines by Herald Magazine. Just Out. Award-winning Scottish artist and author Boo Patterson has released a unique first aid kit for the soul, designed to show how papercraft can help ease the mental health problems linked to the COVID pandemic. The book First Art Kit, 25 Creative Papercraft Remedies for What Ails You, is styled like a vintage first aid kit and offers papercraft remedies to specific problems such as coping with anxiety and insomnia. Patterson started working the book before the pandemic as a form of self-help for her own mental health issues. I suffered from severe depression and have had 23 years of different types of therapy. She says, a few years ago, I was going through another bleak time and began to think, you've had loads of therapy, why don't you make a first aid kit for your brain from the advice you've had? This is how First Art Kit was born. A step-by-step guide to creating homemade butterflies designed to help you soar away from blame is among 25 absorbing art projects that introduces techniques such as paper cutting, collage and book sculpture. Any enjoyable activity that involves deep concentration will alleviate anxiety by allowing the brain to enter a flow state where you don't notice time passing by, explains Patterson. It will also give users a sense of mastery as they develop new skills, which is known to improve self-esteem. First Art Kit is published by Simon & Schuster, £14.99. Broadcaster John Mackay's fourth novel, Home, follows one family over 100 years in the Western Isles. Inspired by the house that his great-grandfather built, Mackay drew on his interest in family history. History is mostly seen through the eyes of the grand families in their grand houses, he says, but it is lived by the ordinary people in their ordinary homes. This is the story of one such family. Mackay's previous novel, The Road Dance, which was set in the Hebrides during the Second World War, has been adapted for film, starring Morven Christie, Hermione Caulfield and Mark Gatiss, and is due for release later this year. Home is published by Louth Press, £9.99. One to watch. Scottish Borders-based Greg Buchanan has been selected as one of Val McDermid's one-to-watch crime fiction writers for 2021. The 16 Horses author will join fellow New Blood panellists Lara Thompson, Patricia Marquez and Anna Bailey to discuss their books at next month's Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival. Buchanan's literary thriller, which is set for a major TV series adaptation, follows the discovery in farmland of 16 horses' heads, each buried with a single eye facing the low winter sun. McDermott has described the story as a deeply disconcerting ride. 16 Horses is published by Pan Macmillan, £16.99. For more information about the Old Peculiar New Blood event, visit harrogateinternationalfestivals.com. Children's Reading. With school holidays underway, parents will welcome a series of book-related digital events for children hosted by Scottish Public Libraries. Hashtag StreamMyStory brings together authors, illustrators, storytellers and libraries from across all 32 local authorities. The online hub offers quality videos designed to encourage young readers' passions for books. Events include Joseph Coelho sharing a reading for early primary-age children from his much-loved Luna Love series, Tom Morgan Jones and Mary Kidd inspiring older primary school children with Strong, Brave, True, Great Scots Who Changed the World. Secondary age children can hear Phil Errol and Michael Wagg discussing the inspiration for their powerful story of an unbreakable friendship, Edgar and Adolf, or listen to writer and illustrator Debbie Gliori's timely discussion about depression through the metaphor of our dragons. More information from mobile.twitter.com/streamastory1. Prizes. Edinburgh-born illustrator Sarah Ogilvie is co-winner of the Indie Book Awards Picture Book Prize for her and writer Julia Donaldson's The Hospital Dog, Pan Macmillan, £8.99. Judges described the book as a story of friendship and canine kindness, which captured the essence of the past year, with children finding warmth and community in challenging moments. The playful rhymes and delightful illustrations make for a winning combination. Ogilvie studied illustration and printmaking at Edinburgh College of Art and has illustrated many children's books since her debut, Dogs Don't Do Ballet, written by Anna Kemp in 2010. By Herald magazine.
The Glasgow Times Sports Section. Thursday, the 1st of July, 2021. Rangers overtake Celtic as most valuable club with whopping market value as wingers price tag rockets. By Mark Hendry. Rangers have overtaken Celtic as the most valuable squad in Scottish football. That's according to new figures at respected data website Transfer Market. Stephen Gerrard's squad is valued at a total of £89.37 million, while rival Celtic sit at £70.83 million in total market value. Celtic still boast the most expensive player in Odsonne Edouard, who is worth, according to the site, £15.3 million, while Gerrard's top market value player is Ryan Kent, whose value has shot up to £12.6 million. Celtic's values in player decreased dramatically in some cases following their disastrous Premiership campaign last term, with the likes of Vasilis Barkas dropping to £2.8 million and Albion Ajeti to £3.2 million. Against the trend, though, once away Chris Ayer's value has increased by £3 million to £7 million. The Light Blues, meanwhile, had a consistent number of players' growth surpass expectations and their value greatly improved. Connor Goldson's price tag went up £2 million to £7.5 million. Joe Aribo shot up £3 million to £6.5 million, and captain James Tavernier continued at £8 million market value. Elsewhere in Scotland, Hibs' market value, £19.55 million, took them to third in the table in front of Aberdeen, £10.96 million, while newly promoted Hearts are fifth with a market value of £7.88 million. Ross County sit at the foot of the market value table with a total of £4.66 million. This article was written by Mark Hendry. The Herald Business Section, Thursday the 1st of July, 2021. Sir David Murray hands over control of family business, by Scott Wright. Former Rangers owner Sir David Murray has passed ownership of his family business onto his sons. Murray Capital Group, which has interests in metals, property and wine, has been taken over by Sir David's sons, David and Keith, under a planned transition of ownership. The brothers acquired the share capital of the company for an undisclosed sum in March. Sir David, who sold Rangers to Craig White in a controversial deal a decade ago, remains chairman of the group. The announcement came as Murray Capital reported a pre-tax loss of £11.6 million for an extended 18-month accounting period ending June 30, 2020. Murray Capital cited the impact of exceptional costs relating to the restructure of its metals business, the impairment of investments because of COVID-19, and trading losses within portfolio companies. However, it declared it expects a return to strong profitability this year. Sir David said, "Running a family business presents many challenges, but it allows you to always think about long-term benefits rather than short-term issues. Being able to transition the ownership successfully to the next generation has been in our plan for many years. I am delighted that we have now achieved this successfully, with David focused on the Murray Capital Group and Keith on our wine business. I am pleased to remain as chairman with an active interest in our core steel business in particular, and a small continuing equity stake. I have been through many ups and downs over the last 50 years in business, as anyone willing to bear risk inevitably does. But I retain great expectations and energy for the next phase. I have complete confidence in my sons, who are willing and able, and for the businesses they now own and lead." This article was written by Scott Wright.
The Herald, Friday the 2nd of July 2021, News. Latvian Air Baltic Edinburgh to Riga route launched. This article is by Brian Donnelly. Latvian airline Air Baltic has today launched flights between Edinburgh and Riga, Latvia. The airline said it now connects both cities with two weekly flights, and a further addition to its service is due next week. Martin Goss, Chief Executive Officer of Air Baltic, hailed the move. He said Riga is a dynamic city and the key business centre of the Baltic states, and has a lot to offer to both businesses and leisure travellers. It is also a very convenient transfer point with excellent connections within our wide route network. He added, "Our expanding 2021 route map reflects the demand we see for destinations after the reopening of more countries for travellers. In addition to the new route, Air Baltic also continues to offer two convenient and safe connections between the United Kingdom and the capital of Latvia, Riga, London and Aberdeen, and on July the 4th will launch a new direct service to Manchester." Flights between Edinburgh and Riga are operated by the Airbus A220-300 aircraft. A complete schedule of AirBaltic flights and tickets for the new destinations are available on the company's website. This article is by Brian Donnelly.
Friday, the 2nd of July, 2021, the Herald Scotland sports section. Ex-Rangers kid Billy Gilmore joins Norwich on loan from Chelsea. Former Rangers youngster Billy Gilmore has joined Norwich City on loan for the season. The midfielder penned a season-long switch from Chelsea after starting for Scotland against England at the Euros. Gilmore was spotted kitted out in Norwich training gear yesterday, and now the move has been made official. Chelsea boss Thomas Tuchel was keen for the 20-year-old to gain some first-team experience in the Premier League after impressing in his bit part role at Stamford Bridge. The Scottish international had been touted for a move back to Ibrox on loan, but Chelsea wanted him to stay in England. He now joins up with fellow Scot Kenny McLean, who he'll be hoping to build a strong partnership with, as well as teaming up with Scotland defender Grant Hanley. Gilmore said, "I'm very excited to be here. I can't wait for the season ahead. I've been looking forward to coming here, playing as much as possible, and helping Norwich City compete in the Premier League. I spoke to the head coach, Daniel Farke, here. He called me and we had a nice talk about how he wants to play and how he sees me fitting in. Everything he said was what I want to do on the pitch, get the ball down and play nice football. He spoke really highly of his team and I wanted to come join here and help. There are very exciting times ahead. Coming in for pre-season and seeing all the lads. Let's get to it." Head coach Daniel Farke told the Norwich club website that Gilmore is a perfect fit for the team. "We are really happy to have brought Billy in. We must say a big thank you to Chelsea and all those involved for making this deal happen," he said. "I think it helped that in the past we have shown that young players with potential are in good hands here at Norwich City. We are delighted to bring Billy in because we've lost some players in that area. We're looking to improve our options, particularly in the centre of the park. And for that, we're happy to bring Billy in. We got the feeling that he could help us a lot with his ability to link the play, his technical qualities and also his work against the ball. From the football point of view, but also from his character, he is a perfect fit to our squad. He will help us achieve our targets. We still have to keep in mind that he is an unbelievably young guy and that he hasn't played regularly on this level. We have to give him some time and space to improve and find his rhythm. All in all, we got the feeling that he can help us achieve our targets and he's a perfect fit for us." Gilmore has made 22 senior appearances for Chelsea and earned his first cap for Scotland at Wembley. Friday, the 2nd of July, 2021, the Herald Scotland sports section. Ange Postecoglou, the latest Celtic manager to believe he can turn Lee Griffiths around, but it's all up to him. It may be fair to say that the revolution Celtic fans hoped for with the arrival of Ange Postecoglou hasn't quite off the ground just yet, despite the arrival of his first signing, Osase Origide, from Sheffield Wednesday yesterday. In fact, it was the news earlier on that Lee Griffiths had joined Tony Ralston in getting a 12-month contract extension, and Postecoglou's seeming willingness to retain the local knowledge provided by coaches John Kennedy and Gavin Strachan that has been so far given the impression of meet the new boss, same as the old boss. It is far too early to be panicking in that regard, with more new bodies sure to arrive, but both Postecoglou and new chief executive could do with a statement signing or two to ease the minds of worried supporters. As for the matter at hand, on the face of it, it would appear a relatively sensible decision to retain the services of an experienced striker perhaps the most natural finisher in the country, especially as Odson Edward looks likely to be sold on. There are significant caveats, though. The fact that news of the extension was met by consternation from many Celtic supporters when it was announced yesterday is a sign of how far Griffith's star has fallen. Perhaps that is why he cryptically unfollowed all of Celtic's social media accounts on Wednesday, so he wouldn't have to read it. Griffiths has just turned 31, and due to a combination of personal problems out with his control and lack of professionalism entirely within his command, he has not been able to nail down a place as a regular starter across a whole season since he smashed 40 goals in season 2015-16. There have been sporadic outbursts of form, most recently when paired with Edward under Neil Lennon, particularly in the period from the turn of the year two seasons ago, when the player dovetailed brilliantly to spearhead Celtic's charge towards a ninth title in a row. But relations between Griffiths and Lennon deteriorated to the point where the pair have held a public war of words over the striker's commitment and conditioning for the media over the past 2 weeks. The point of Lennon's disgruntlement came when Griffiths reported back for duty after the first COVID-19 lockdown last year, wildly out of shape. When he was left behind to work on his fitness at Lennox Town, as the rest of the squad headed to France for a pre-season tournament, it was widely thought that the forward had finally reached last orders in the last chance saloon. And yet, Lennon came around, believing that he could get Griffiths ship-shape and firing once more. It was about this time that Cat started referring to those who have had a near-death experience as having more lives than Griffiths. Griffiths argues that he did in fact reapply himself and was fit enough to be starting games. He remained a peripheral figure though, starting rarely and coming off the bench at other times to mixed effect. There were flashes of his finishing prowess here and there, but as question marks over his fitness remained, he couldn't get a regular game time required to stake a claim for Steve Clarke's Scotland squad, missing out even on the expanded 26-man roster. Griffiths refused to accept that he had reached the end of the road, though, with either club or country, reiterating his belief that he can still score goals at the highest level. That has really been in doubt, but it is hugely questionable whether he has the defensive capabilities or the level of work rate required to press high up the pitch in the manner which Postecoglou orders his teams to. Whatever he has said to his new manager, Postecoglou has been convinced enough of his good intentions to offer him the opportunity to sink or swim under his new regime. His message, though, has been very much that he will no longer be afforded special treatment and that his future is now entirely in his own hands. He has no other choice but to spell that out clearly and publicly, with many fans taking his decision to retain Griffiths as a signal to the rest of the squad that a lack of professionalism will not only be tolerated but rewarded. I'm really pleased to keep Lee with us for another season at least, Postecoglou said yesterday. I have had very positive conversations with Lee, and he clearly understands my expectations and more importantly, the club's. It is important, his words from last week's press conference, that Griffiths should heed most closely though. When asked if players would thrive under the punishing world-class sporting environment he would be creating at Celtic, Postecoglou replied, "Not at all. My experience tells me that in the environment I create, some thrive for sure, but others will really struggle. And if you don't have a choice in who they are going to be, that's how I measure staff and players." I know people are keen to know what changes we are going to make, but I come from the perspective that we would rather make the decisions ourselves after we change the environment. There are decisions I have to retake responsibility for, so I will make them. I think some of the players will definitely thrive in the environment. That will make decisions easy. One of his first decisions has been to hand Griffiths the chance to prove whether his doubters are right or wrong once and for all, It's all up to him now. Friday, the 2nd of July, 2021, the Herald Scotland sports section. Gary McAllister details Rangers' title obsession and makes Leeds and Liverpool comparison. Gary McAllister has revealed Rangers were obsessed with winning last season as they clinched a 55th Premiership title. The champions ended the campaign with an unbeaten top-flight record as they also reached the last 16 of the Europa League for the second consecutive season. McAllister enjoyed a sterling playing career south of the border, most notably with Leeds United and Liverpool, and has played a key role as part of Steven Gerrard's staff over the last three seasons. His efforts have now been rewarded with a sought-after league flag, and the Ibrox assistant manager has detailed the mindset of the squad that has written their name into Rangers folklore. McAllister told the Rangers official souvenir magazine, "Being part of success at Leeds United and Liverpool, you just wanted to be part of it again. Why would you not? I felt Leeds was a club where you had a chance of winning things, and then at Liverpool you had a greater chance of that, and with all the history and tradition there. Rangers is one of the most successful clubs in the world, so when you play here, and now that when we have that first trophy in the bag, why wouldn't you believe you can keep going? Everything here is going towards winning, and the expectation levels are always there. Even in the lowest days this club has been through in recent times, it was set up to win. The fans want that, and it is a winning club, so this is a great opportunity for the players to go and really jump forward with more success. When you look at the staff as a whole, there is not a shyness about anybody, so they have got that moment to speak when they want it. I don't think anyone shies away from putting their head above the parapet and saying what they think. That is key to how we work. It is an open room and there are people in there that are always like-minded in what they want to win. They are obsessed when it comes to wanting to win matches and trophies and coming up with ideas. We have people who organise the training who are second to none, and when you put all these things together with that thirst for wanting to win, you've always got a chance."
Herald Scotland recorded on Friday, 2nd of July 2021. Drew Allen, The Herald in a Scottish Perspective, by Drew Allen, features writer and columnist. We discussed in this slot some time ago the growing incidence of Americanisms in our language, which was irritating some of our readers. This week, let's turn our attention to another common bugbear, the incidence of Anglicisms. The matter was raised recently by reader Carol Primrose, who fumed, "I was upset to find what I assumed to be a trustworthy newspaper furthering the dishonest claim by the RSPCA that it operates in Britain. The RSPCA can only operate in England and Wales. It has no remit in Scotland, which is served by the Scottish SPCA. The offending statement appeared in a Herald magazine preview of the Channel 5 show The Dog Rescuers, which contained the line that the RSPCA was working to keep Britain's dogs safe. Point taken. We're proud to be a Scottish national newspaper. We're of course the longest running national newspaper in the world, as we boast on our front page every day, and we need to be on our guard against such inaccuracies. The error was made, as it often is, in copy supplied by an agency, in this case the Press Association, PEA as it's popularly known, provides services to newspapers the length and breadth of Britain, and is not expected to fine-tune every article it transmits to take into account national differences or sensitivities. That is our job. It's a task we approach with diligence. I would hope you would not read in the Herald about cases of arson taking place north of the border, rather willful or reckless fire-raising. Similarly, housebreaking, not burglary. PA also supplies copy for our regular On This Day feature, which appears in this page. This may, for example, mention James 1, whom we will refer to as James 6, brackets, unless, of course, the item is about the King of Scots who reigned from 1406 to 1437, close brackets. We try to be sensitive to regnal numbers, which often raise the hackles of Herald readers. Brackets, PA also recently referred to the Clydebank shipyard in Scotland. Neil Bowman was among several readers who were exorcised by this superfluity, and the phrase ought to have been excised. Close brackets. There are other pitfalls regularly to be avoided. We need to make the clear distinction between UK and Scottish ministers. We must ensure no one refers to the defendant in a Scottish court case. We should draw the distinction between Scottish charities such as the National Trust for Scotland and those that operate down south. There is also the issue of royal titles, which we have discussed previously. Does all this really matter? I would argue that it does. It is not a matter of nationality politics, no matter what proponents or opponents of independence might think. It's about serving two of the main masters in newspaper reporting, accuracy and clarity. Our readers expect and deserve no less. By Drew Allen.
The Herald Business Section. Friday, the 2nd of July, 2021. American Independence document found in attic of Scott's home sells for more than $4 million. By Deborah Anderson. A rare piece of founding American history has sold for $4,420,000, £3,210,000, after being discovered in the attic of a Scottish ancestral home by fine art auctioneers. Lyon and Turnbull made the discovery in a set of documents and passed the find on to its sister auction house, Freeman's, in America. A signer's copy of the 1776 Declaration of Independence, one of only six known still to be in private hands, was uncovered by the Edinburgh headquartered auction house after one of its specialists was asked to look at some books and papers. The press achieved its second highest ever paid out auction for any copy of the Declaration of Independence, the highest for an American document printed in the 19th century, and quadruples the world record for a William J. Stone printing of the Declaration previously set in New York in 2019. The historic document, which has been unaccounted for nearly 180 years, is one of two copies presented to Founding Father Charles Carroll of Carrollton in 1824, a wealthy American and the first United States Senator from the state of Maryland. Mr. Carroll gave both of his copies to his grandson-in-law John McTavish, 1787 to 1852, a Scottish-Canadian diplomat and businessman who served as British consul to Maryland and married Mr. Carroll's granddaughter, Emily Caton. One of the copies was given to Maryland Historical Society by Mr. McTavish. He then copied Mr. Carroll's signature and inscription from that copy onto this second copy, adding a note of his own to explain. Mr. Carroll was an early advocate for independence of the 13th American colonies from Great Britain and was to become the last survivor of the 56 signatories, dying in 1832, aged 96. Together the colonies formed the United States of America. Lyon and Turnbull's rare books, manuscripts and maps specialist Kathy Marsden, who made the discovery, said, "I was looking through a pile of papers which had been brought down from the attic, amongst which was a folded up vellum document. Opening up, I could see a copy of the Declaration of Independence. When I got back to the office and started doing some research, I became really excited as its significance became clearer. After extensive research, we confirmed it was indeed one of the 201 copies made by William Stone, of which only 48 of them are known to still exist. Being able to identify to whom the copy belonged made it even more exciting and rare. Freeman's and Lyon and Turnbull formed a transatlantic link more than 20 years ago with a special focus on single owner collections. The two companies have successfully staged a wide range of joint international projects over the last two decades, including specialist auctions in Hong Kong and London, as well as exhibitions and events on both sides of the Atlantic. Paul Roberts, Vice Chairman of Lyon and Turnbull and President of Freeman's in Philadelphia, said, "This was a great effort from both teams on both sides of the Atlantic, a very proud moment for me personally. An international team working in perfect harmony to achieve wonderful result on behalf of an extremely appreciative and supportive client." When Kathy Marsden first showed me this document on Christmas Eve, I knew it was interesting, but today's outcome, achieving $4,420,000, £3,210,000, on the eve of Independence Day weekend, nearly 4,000 miles away, is extraordinary. I am delighted that our international partnership is now regularly bringing results in the millions thanks to the combined work of our specialist teams. The vendors, who remain anonymous, wish to thank Leon and Turnbull and Freemans for finding the document and arranging such a successful outcome. This article was written by Deborah Anderson. The Herald Business Section, Friday the 2nd of July, 2021. Latvian Air Baltic Edinburgh to Riga route launched by Brian Donnelly. Latvian airline Air Baltic has today launched flights between Edinburgh and Riga, Latvia. The airline said it now connects both cities with two weekly flights, and a further addition to its service is due next week. Martin Gauss, Chief Executive Officer of Air Baltic, hailed the move. He said Riga is a dynamic city and the key business centre of the Baltic states and has a lot to offer to both businesses and leisure travellers. It is also a very convenient transfer point with excellent connections within our wide route network. He added, "Our expanding 2021 route map reflects the demand we see for destinations after the reopening of more countries for travellers. In addition to the new route, Air Baltic also continues to offer two convenient and safe connections between the United Kingdom and the capital of Latvia, Riga, London and Aberdeen, and on July 4th will launch a new direct service to Manchester. Flights between Edinburgh and Riga are operated by the Airbus A220-300 aircraft. A complete schedule of Air Baltic flights and tickets for the new destinations are available on the company's website." This article was written by Brian Donnelly.
The Herald, Sunday the 4th of July 2021. News. Coronavirus. Scotland definitely on track to ease restrictions on July the 19th, say experts. This article is by Helen McArdle. Scotland can definitely go ahead with plans to lift the next phase of COVID restrictions on July the 19th, despite soaring case numbers, an expert in infectious diseases has said. Christine Tate Burkard, an assistant professor of zoonotic viruses at Edinburgh University, said she was also quite a bit happier with the Scottish Government's goal of delaying the end to social distancing until August, around 3 weeks later than England. It comes as the UK Government's new Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, said there were compelling arguments for ending all restrictions, including mandatory face masks, due to the harms caused by long-term lockdowns, but admitted that coronavirus cases are going to rise significantly as a result. Scotland has experienced a string of record-breaking daily case numbers over the past week, including over 4,000 on Thursday, and currently has the highest COVID rates in the UK, with an estimated 1 in 150 people infected, compared to 1 in 260 in England. Earlier this week, First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said the higher prevalence of infections north of the border could be due to the highly transmissible Delta variant having seeded into Scotland initially through Glasgow, its most populous city, as well as lower antibody levels in the population because virus rates had tended to be lower than other parts of the UK previously in the pandemic. Speaking on the BBC Sunday show, however, Professor Tate Burkard said she did not believe the current situation should stall plans to move the whole of Scotland into level zero from July the 19th. She said vaccination is underway and we're looking at close to 100% uptake in adults by July the 19th with the first jab, and we already know that most of the severe disease risk gets reduced by that significantly. So I think we can definitely go through the next step on the 19th of July, despite the numbers. That sounds absolutely mad, but hospitalisation numbers still look encouraging, and the vaccination programme still looks encouraging, but I'm quite a bit happier with the Scottish approach to eventually releasing everything in August only. Level zero is expected to mean an end to physical distancing outdoors in Scotland and would allow larger groups to meet indoors in hospitality venues and private homes. This is scheduled to be followed once vaccination coverage is higher by beyond zero on August the 9th, when venues such as pubs and restaurants may be allowed to return to full capacity indoors without distancing, although it is likely that advice on wearing face coverings will remain in place for shops and public transport, and it is unclear whether nightclubs will reopen at this stage. In England, nightclubs are due to reopen from July the 19th with mandatory physical distancing and face coverings replaced by personal responsibility. Downing Street is also considering proposals to allow fully vaccinated people to avoid self-isolation if they come into contact with an infected person, with quarantine replaced by advice to test themselves for the virus regularly instead. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, Health Secretary Mr. Javid said the government had to be honest with people about the fact that we cannot eliminate COVID. He added, "We also need to be clear that cases are going to rise significantly. I know many people will be cautious about the easing of restrictions. That's completely understandable. But no date we choose will ever come without risk, so we have to take a broad and balanced view. We are going to have to learn to accept the existence of COVID and find ways to cope with it, just as we already do with flu." He added that the decision was based on balancing COVID and non-COVID harms. Mr. Javid said, "The economic arguments for opening up are well known, but for me, the health arguments are equally compelling. Rules that we have had to put in place have caused a shocking rise in domestic violence and a terrible impact on so many people's mental health. In Scotland, nearly 24,000 COVID cases were recorded in the 7 days to June the 2nd, the highest ever weekly toll. The number of people in hospital with COVID rose from 114 to 285 between June the 2nd and July the 2nd, though intensive care cases have remained much lower, climbing from 10 to 19 over the same period. The number of people dying with confirmed COVID in Scotland has risen from 10 between May the 2nd and June the 2nd to 56 in the month to July the 2nd. Amid the spiralling case numbers, Test and Protect contact tracers in Scotland are now prioritising cases where there is a high risk of transmission, with texts used instead where cases are deemed low risk. Professor Tate Burkhard said her own conversations with Public Health Scotland colleagues suggest that people are becoming less willing to comply with requests to self-isolate. She said, "We see people are not willing to pick up the phone, they're not as willing to provide information, and they're not as willing to isolate, especially when they have been double jabbed and have, for instance, holiday plans for this summer. So at this moment, I think that Test and Protect is still an important part, but we still also have to focus on the other aspects of both vaccination, but also testing at larger high-risk events." She added that despite the stresses on the system, testing appeared to be picking up a higher proportion of cases, around 50%, now compared to 22% in January, based on the Office for National Statistics surveillance estimates for how many infections are genuinely present in the community at any one time. This article is by Helen McArdle. The Herald, Monday the 5th of July 2021, News. Kennel Club survey, businesses urged to welcome dogs to avoid rehoming after lockdown puppy boom. This article is by Sarah Pacchiaroni. Nearly two-thirds of Scots are worried about what will happen to dogs that were bought during the coronavirus pandemic, according to new research. The Kennel Club study, part of its Open for Dogs campaign, suggests 64% of people in Scotland are worried the pets will be abandoned when normal life resumes. Across the UK, nearly one in five respondents, 17%, admitted they had considered rehoming as an option post-lockdown. The study also found almost half, 49% of Scots, say there are not enough businesses accommodating four-legged friends, despite their benefits, especially as the country has dealt with COVID-19. More than three in five, 62% of people agreed more customers would visit venues such as pubs and cafes, which struggled during lockdown, if dogs were also allowed in. Bill Lambert, the Kennel Club spokesman, said, "This new research worryingly shows that if dogs can't go to places with their owners and fit their lifestyle post-pandemic, some will be left home alone for too long, or even sadly rehomed or abandoned. These consequences could be quite devastating for the nation's dogs, who frankly don't deserve to be left behind after being there for so many during lockdown. Hospitality, businesses and workplaces can play a role in combating the looming welfare crisis faced by this pandemic pup generation by being open for dogs, helping owners to introduce or reintroduce their pet to normal without leaving them behind, and preventing a legacy of separation anxiety. Following a year of lockdown restrictions impacting business, dog-friendly policies can also reap economic benefits across the board. According to our research, more than one in two owners claim they would happily stay longer and spend more if their dog was with them while out socialising at a pub, cafe or restaurant. While there may have been some short-sighted puppy buying decisions made during the pandemic, as a dog-loving nation, we must look at the bigger picture and encourage more places to welcome dogs, capitalise on the benefits and paw it back, easing our four-legged friends out of lockdown, opening up more widely for their re-entry to normal life and celebrating their positive place within our society. Dogs should be a part of our lives and daily routines as much as possible, and we hope to see the UK being as faithful to dogs as they are and have been to us." This article is by Sarah Pacchiarini.
From the Herald Scotland, dated Monday, 5th July 2021, from the Voices section. War on cars, woo the public, or this will be a battle zone. An article by Vicky Allen, Senior Features Writer. There's a lot of grumbling in Edinburgh, as in many cities, about what people see as the war on cars. If you want to hit nerves or set off a blazing row, certainly in Leith, where I live, just mention any of the following. Low traffic neighbourhoods, spaces for people, controlled parking zones, and the trams. It is in some ways a kind of road culture war, and what it has in common with other growing culture wars is that it touches on issues of personal freedom. Though of course it's about more than that, because cars have been made so central to how we satisfy many of our needs. Our society is now structured that way. There are good reasons, of course, to urge diligence in getting low traffic plans right. Among them, the impact on local business accessibility for those with disabilities and the possibility of creating alternative rat runs. But often it seems to me what people are raging against is a threat to a way of life. The right to own a car also sometimes seems like the equivalent of the US right to bear arms. Vital because, for many, it offers a cocoon of protection. Cars are wheels with which to flee trouble. They are pleasure too, and a means to escape our everyday lives. They are status and privilege. They allow us to transport things we need. A car can buy us time. Our flexible diaries and schedules often are built around driving. But then when we sit in congested routes, we feel that time stolen from us. No wonder road rage exists, and alongside it, the fear that more road closures will mean more jams. One of the things that interests me about the war on cars and road closure debate is it seems like an example of the problem net zero leaders, climate action politicians and climate change activists are likely to face in the coming years. What we need is a transition, not a war. And with the planet ever heating, we can't afford for this to be perceived as one. Some of the kickback against these changes stems from the fact that the changes going on where we live are taking place at great speed, with many of them arriving within months of each other, and there has been not enough community consultation. Not all the public are being taken willingly on this off-road journey. The fast change required to get us to net zero targets, a very green aim, sit uncomfortably with green ideals around local democracy and community consultation. I see a long future sweeping up ahead, dominated by such tensions, and by the issue of how to create necessary change without kickback from a public that wants net zero, but without the changes. The only solution has to be a lot of intense consultation and media discussion rapidly. The public has to know and be on board with what is coming. But right now, eyes are more on the ball of COVID. Of course, one of the long-term answers in terms of emissions could just be that the switch to electric cars is ramped up as rapidly as possible. But modelling of future cities often suggests that what is actually needed is reduced car ownership. And there are multiple other arguments for weaning ourselves off car use, not least our health. A podcast I listened to recently featuring the brain scientist Shane O'Mara persuaded me we need to be talking much more about walking cities as a replacement for our drive and gym model of fitness. He argues that walking isn't just good for our bodies, it's good for our brains, and what humans in particular evolved to do a great deal of. At all of the points of the day, he recommends, whenever you're moving around, we should make it easier to just put one foot in front of the other without thinking about it. Cars and the urban spaces we now have designed around their flow are among the things that stop us doing that. Just listening to O'Mara's research made me want to get on my feet and wander, to see the car as a prison for my legs and the freedom to walk, one of the most important of all. This article was by Vicky Allen, Senior Features Writer. From the Herald Scotland, dated Monday, 5th July 2021, from the Voices section. Whatever our politics, gaslighting corrodes national confidence and self-esteem. An article by Doug Marr. Gaslighting has become shorthand for a form of emotional and psychological abuse that leads someone to question their capabilities, experiences, memories, and ultimately their grasp of reality. Its roots lie in Patrick Hamilton's 1938 play, Gaslight, also known as Angel Street in the US, that became the two 1940s movies entitled Gaslight. In all three, a manipulative husband messes with his wife's mind to the extent that she begins to doubt her own sanity. One of his unsettling tactics is to regularly dim the gas lamps in their home and convince her that she is imagining it. Gaslighting is usually associated with one-sided relationships between couples, in which one systematically undermines the other's self-confidence, independence, and ability to take decisions. More recently, it has become apparent that groups as well as individuals can be victims, and gaslighting has become a recognised destabilising political tactic. Political gaslighting usually involves the manipulation and misrepresentation of facts, denial and downright lying to control people, their beliefs and actions. It's often used to divert attention from political and governmental failings by systematically attacking and discrediting opponents. Gaslighting is easier and more effective where there is an imbalance in power in relationships between individuals, but also between political forces. A governing party, for example, that controls or is supported by swathes of the media will find it much easier to blacken and undermine opposing groups and ideas. The phenomenon was identified in an article by psychologist Christy Taylor, entitled Gaslighting, the Political Tactic of Our Time, and published on the open platform Medium. In a similar vein, Robin Stern, in her piece, The Gaslight Effect, claims that never before have we seen the scale of serial lying that involves consistent denial and obfuscation. Both detail ex-President Trump's instinctive gaslighting of opponents who challenged his views or position. As president, Mr. Trump regularly characterized opponents as nasty, liars, not very smart, fat, slobs, etc. Mexicans and Latinos in general were bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. Mr. Trump also gaslighted critics and scientists to divert attention from his disastrous mishandling of COVID that possibly cost thousands of American lives. Mr. Trump displayed all the hallmarks of the serial gaslighter through repeated use of negative stereotypes, by trivialising and underplaying others' concerns, by denial and refusing to engage in meaningful debate. Of course, gaslighting has been employed much nearer home. Indeed, the Scottish experience suggests that entire nations can be gaslighted. What's more, we don't need outsiders to inflict it upon us. We are more than capable of gaslighting ourselves. During the 2014 independence campaign, Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling were central to a gaslighting campaign that essentially set out to undermine national confidence and self-belief. The strategy was similar to that of the manipulative husband in the Gaslight movies, leading his wife to doubt her competence and ability to take decisions and organise her own life. Gaslighting was central to Project Fear, drawing on massive whoppers like The Vow and Vote No if you wish Scotland to remain in the EU. The implied message being the dependency culture is so ingrained in Scots that we shouldn't be out on our own and couldn't survive without our friends in the South. And it worked like a dream. The 2014 referendum was never going to mark the end of the independence debate, and if anything, gaslighting on both sides has become even more intense. Unquestionably, many issues such as the currency, a national bank, and trading relationships with the remaining UK require calm and rational debate. Gaslighting, however, is the very antithesis of rationality. It's not built on facts, but relies on making others feel collectively stupid, inadequate, or insecure. It corrodes personal and national self-esteem, self-confidence, and belief that lie at the heart of all confident and successful countries. I recently watched again the BBC documentary Finding Jack Charlton. It's not an easy watch as Jack descends into the twilight world of dementia. What was uplifting, however, was the part he played as a football manager and as a remarkable man in helping Ireland feel good about itself. It's that can-do attitude that has made a huge contribution to Ireland's ability to modernise and reinvent itself. I couldn't help contrast Irish positivity with some of the online reactions to Scotland's elimination from the Euros. Mystifyingly, some interpreted the Croatia result as the kick in the teeth for the independence movement in general, and the First Minister in particular. The gaslighters probably failed to spot the irony that Croatia, population around 4 million and with far fewer resources than Scotland, seems to be getting along just dandy. Scottish gaslighting is also tainted by more than a hint of misogyny. Irish female leaders such as Mary Robinson and Mary McAleese are treated with almost universal respect in marked contrast to the cowardly abuse directed at Scottish female politicians of all parties. Scottish gaslighting is all about making others feel inadequate and bad about themselves and what they are capable of. Its essential negativity is summed up in the cliché that Scotland is too small, daft and poor to go it alone. There must be something in the water that makes Scots more stupid and incapable than the inhabitants of Denmark, Finland, Norway, Ireland, New Zealand, and many other thriving small countries. In fairness, gaslighting is not confined to any one political group or philosophy. We can only hope that something so corrosive is not irredeemably embedded in the national psyche. If so, whether in or out of the UK, we are all worse off if we allow the negativity of gaslighting to undermine our collective self-esteem and confidence in our own capability. This article was by Doug Marr.
Herald Scotland recorded on Monday, 5th of July 2021. Arts and Entertainments. A Brutalist Ghost, Can St Peter's Seminary Be Revived? By Vicky Allen, Senior Features Writer. A concrete ghost haunts the woods near Cardross. St Peter's Seminary, a giant structure considered to be Scotland's most significant post-war building, has been derelict for decades now. In spite of the energetic and inspiring efforts of arts organisation NVA to bring it back to life, plant life grows between its cracks, graffiti tattoos its skin. Built in the 1960s as a Roman Catholic seminary under the influence of Le Corbusier and designed by Glasgow architects Ise Metstein and Andy McMillan, its glory days are long gone. It has been part consumed by nature, reduced, as Historic Environment Scotland, HES, once put it, to a ruinous skeleton. In 2019, after the Catholic Church described it as an albatross around its neck, the Scottish Government declined to step in and save the building because of its costs. A HES report had estimated that just maintaining it and making it safe for public access would cost in excess of £13 million over 20 years. This prompted Angus Farquhar, who is Artistic Director of NVA, had fought to create a future for the site, to declare that Scotland had turned its back in the 20th century. Farquhar and his team had led a bold drive to conserve and revive the site, creating the sellout art event Hinterland, cleaning up the building and creating community plots in the walled garden, but the loss of Creative Scotland core funding led not only to the closing down of NVA's St Peter's project, but of NVA itself. But all is not entirely over for this brutalist treasure. Last year, the Kilmahue Education Trust, headed by a husband and wife team, took over the site for no cost from the Archdiocese of Glasgow, with the intention of developing it as an asset for the local community. Their plan is to develop it as a World Heritage Centre, with estimated visitor numbers of 375,000 and a turnover of £12.5 million a year. Their estimated cost to achieve this come in at more than £100 million. Hope is not yet gone. The ghost may yet be brought back to life. I would certainly visit, as I did in 2016 when NVA transformed the ruined structures with a spectacular pulsating light show. Memories linger of the graffitied corners and the giant sensor which swung across the glowing interior to the sounds of Rory Boyle's choral score. I would like to go back and see it in the daylight, restored. By Vicky Allen. Herald Scotland recorded on Monday, 5th of July 2021. Arts and Entertainments. Issue of the Day. The Blight and Racism Row Rages On. By Maureen Sugden, reporter. Her children's books are among the world's best selling, but the outdated language featuring in Enid Blyton's work has again been branded racist in a row that refuses to dissipate. The Famous Five and The Secret Seven Adventures are among our best-known Blyton books, along with Noddy and Mallory Towers. The author, born in 1897 in London, was a full-time writer from the age of 24, penning more than 700 books which have sold more than 600 million copies and still continue to sell about 8 million copies a year. Blyton has been accused of being racist for decades. An article in The Guardian back in 1966 first raised the issue, noting the stories of the then recently published The Little Black Doll, which told the tale of a doll called Sambo, who was only loved by its owner when its ugly black face was washed clean by rain. Noddy. The Noddy books featured the little wooden toy and his friends who lived in Toyland, including Big Ears the Gnome and others, including Gollywogs, rag dolls depicted with highly offensive representations of black people at the time. These characters were later removed from new editions. In recent years, in 2016, a commemorative 50p Blyton coin was rejected by the Royal Mint because the Advisory Committee in Minutes record she was a racist, sexist, homophobe and not a very well-regarded writer. What's happening now? Earlier this month, English Heritage said there were no plans whatsoever to remove a blue plaque in situ at her former home in London, stating that she lived there in the early 1920s. However, The organisation added, "We can fit about 19 words in each plaque. Our website provides a fuller picture of the person's life, including any uncomfortable aspects. And so the information page in the website has been updated to reflect wider opinion. In a section, Racism in Blyton's Work, it states, Blyton's work has been criticised during her lifetime and after for its racism, xenophobia and lack of literary merit. It does also present another side. It points out that others have argued that while these charges can't be dismissed, her work still played a vital role in encouraging a generation of children to read. In response, Piers Morgan tweeted, Leave Enid Blyton alone, you woke, ..." And comedian and author David Baddiel tweeted, Re-Enid Blyton, racism yes, xenophobia yes, but lack of literary merit about books that have sold 600 million copies just sounds weirdly snooty. In the latest developments, Andy Oliver, a judge in BBC Two's Great British Menu, whose family hails from Antigua, has spoken about her humiliating experiences reading Blyton in school. Reigniting debate, she tweeted, Gollywog or N... is a humiliating, painful experience that made me scared of playtime because the words we were reading inspired the bullies and it did, yes, shape how I felt about myself. I liked The Famous Five too, but it doesn't mean the woman's writing didn't scar me. By Maureen Sugden.
The Herald, Tuesday the 6th of July 2021. News. Renewables help Renfrewshire leather firm cut carbon footprint. This article is by Mark Williamson. Scottish Leather Group has said it is on course to be carbon neutral by 2025 after investing heavily in support of a drive to reduce emissions associated with its production. The Bridge of Weir based company said it has recorded a carbon footprint of 1.1 kilogram of carbon dioxide per hide, representing a 90% reduction from 10.3 kilograms two decades ago. The company said the reduction reflected the benefit of the multi-million pound investment it has made in facilities required to turn its own waste into energy and to treat and recover water used in the production process. The company, which supplies leather used in cars and aircraft, says all its hides are the byproduct of the beef and dairy industries, with over 98% sourced in the UK and Ireland. It reckons its tannery uses 50% less water per hide than the industry standard. The water used in production is sourced from the company's own loch. Some 40% of the water used is filtered and recycled. The remainder is treated and returned to original watershed. The group developed a thermal energy plant in which waste is converted into heat, avoiding the need for it to be sent to landfill. It has formed a partnership with luxury goods firm Milbury, whose range includes bags under which end-of-life leather will be recovered for use as fuel. The company said this forms part of a pioneering take-back scheme, which will ensure that old leather contributes to the manufacture of new products. Warren Bowden, Sustainability and Innovation Director at the group, said, It is absolutely clear that sustainability is going to be at the core of decision-making going forward and that a linear approach where waste ends up in landfill will not be accepted. Within the manufacturing industry in particular, there is a huge responsibility to act fast, but there is also an opportunity to help to meet customer-driven environmental targets. The Scottish Government has set a target for the country to achieve net zero in terms of carbon dioxide emissions by 2045, ahead of the 2050 target set by the UK Government. This article is by Mark Williamson.
Recorded from the Herald on the 6th of July 2021, from the sports section. Hearts seal coup, Celtic signing, as academy coach leaves Parkhead for Tynecastle setup, by Mark Hendry. Hearts have confirmed the appointment of former Celtic Academy coach John McLaughlin. The experienced trainer has been working as part of the Parkhead setup since 2005. He has coached the under-17s, under-19s and led the Intermediate Academy during a 17-year spell at Celtic Park. But the Jambos prized him away to work alongside sporting director Joe Savage's football department at the club, a move the Hearts staffer describes as a coup. Speaking to the Hearts Club website about the appointment, Savage said, "I'm really happy that we've managed to John on board. He has a wealth of experience in the game here in Scotland, and crucially, he has specialised in youth development. It's no secret that we're focusing a lot on creating a pathway from youth level to the first team, and to have John here passing on his knowledge and mentoring our youth coaches is hugely excited. To get someone in John who is so established in academy football to really believe in the vision we have set out, and for him to be one to deliver it, it's a definite coup for us." That article was by Mark Hendry. Recorded from the Herald on the 6th of July 2021. From the sports section, legendary Rangers bosses set for 150th anniversary celebration dinner by Christopher Jack. Four legendary Rangers managers are set to be reunited in Glasgow as part of a special event to celebrate the club's 150th anniversary. Graham Souness, Walter Smith, Dick Advocaat and Alex McLeish will form a trophy-laden top table at a historic dinner next March. The event is being run by Five Stars Limited and tickets will go on sale later this week as supporters get the chance to see the hugely successful quartet together. Five Stars announced the dinner on their Instagram page on Tuesday evening and said, "As part of our upcoming calendar of events to celebrate the 150th anniversary of RFC, we are delighted to present our manager's evening. Graham Souness, Walter Smith, Dick Advocaat, Alex McLeish and a selection of past players will make this incredibly special event one not to be missed. After speaking to all four managers in the past week, they are as excited for this event as we are. The night with Souness, Smith, Advocaat and McLeish is just one part of a series of events that will be put on as Rangers become the first major European club to reach the 150-year landmark. Rangers will do so, of course, as champions of Scotland after Steven Gerrard's side clinched the Premiership title last term. And now fans will have the chance to hear stories from successes of yesteryear as four Ibrox legends come together once again." That article was by Christopher Jack.
From the Herald Scotland, dated Tuesday, 6 July 2021, from the Voices section. The do's and don'ts of dating in the post-pandemic world. An article by Uzma Mia. Online dating has gone through the roof during the pandemic, we are told, with all the big players like Match, Bumble, Hinge and Tinder reporting huge increases in memberships as singletons sought solace and connection with their newly found virtual boyfriends or girlfriends. But as coronavirus restrictions ease, the virtual becomes the real, and Google searches for where to go on a first date have shot back up the internet suggestions list. Food is a favourite, apparently, and in her column for The National last week, Roxane Sirushian mentioned a survey by European bakery experts Saint-Pierre that caught my eye. According to the survey of 2,000 people, a third thought that a first date should involve food. So, being a veteran of this very scenario, and having been asked recently for advice on this, I thought I would do my public service bit to help those who might be thinking about a food first date navigate those tricky waters. The biggest negative with the going for food option is that once you've sat down for the meal, there's really no going back. You've committed to that hour. Even if in the first 30 seconds you can tell it's a no from me, from either or both parties. Many years ago, I walked into a restaurant in Finiston in Glasgow, a couple of minutes late, to see my date's face crumple before my eyes as he looked me up and down. Clearly the cowboy boots and tartan skirt combo wasn't working on my somewhat thick body. What followed was one of the most strained hours of my life, as he told me about his triathlon training and nibbled tentatively on a bean salad, while I tucked into a rather tasty battered fish and chips. So painful was the hour that when he said he had to run to a business meeting in Aberdeen, I urged him to go immediately and I would get the bill. It's also the moment when food etiquette faux pas can bring on just a hint of judgmentalism. I must admit to having felt a flicker of doubt when I watched a rather lovely man noisily sucking the marrow out of a bone, and another lasciviously licking their knife. And don't start me on the chap who started picking unfinished food on my plate on a first date. You've literally and metaphorically crossed a line there, mate. He clearly didn't recognise boundaries. And for those of us who enjoy a bit of spaghetti, let's not forget to wrap it round the fork using our spoons to avoid it dangling down so we resemble one of the Ood from Doctor Who, or sucking it up so violently that the sauce splatters in our eyes, momentarily blinding us. But food first dates do hold useful clues about our potential mates when it comes to their interactions with the waiting staff. Finger clickers and no tippers need not apply. And as for those who are just plain rude to staff, let me tell you from bitter experience, the writing is on the wall. On the flip side, I remember going to an Iranian restaurant and seeing someone so genuinely interested in cultural nuances and so at ease and chatty with the Iranian staff that my heart definitely melted a wee bit. Unfortunately, he was sitting at the table next to me with a similarly impressed-looking woman. The path towards love is cruel sometimes. Then there is the thorny question of the bill. On this issue, I do feel sorry for men. They've been told that we women, trying to shake off the shackles of the patriarchy, are happy to pay our own way. But as witnessed on the Channel 4 First Dates programme, the slightly huffy looks on the faces of the women who go halfers says it all. Apparently, we do expect a man to pay on the first date, and most times it seems they do. Indeed, the fella I mentioned earlier did ring me up some months later to suggest another lunch date because I had paid for the first one. So intrigued was I, and obviously sensing that years later I'd write a column about it, that I went along, this time not wearing the tartan and cowboy boots combo, but something a bit more conservative, only to be told later that I reminded him of his mother. That's definitely in the top 10 weirdest reasons to be blown out, but hey, at least we're equal now. For some, the whole looking across the table at someone they have never met before can be wildly unsettling. The awkward silences, the tricky conversations. Brexit and cancel culture are, in my experience, the worst romance killers, or even maintaining eye contact can unnerve. The anxiety can be tempered by a more side-by-side activity like going to the cinema, a gallery, or going to a concert. That way, if the conversation does dry up, as it does if the date is not going that well, but you still have the main course to come, you can seamlessly steer the chat towards the activity or others around you. So if you're thinking about what to do now that dating can properly get back to meeting up, I would suggest a simple coffee or a walk in the park. Anything to avoid the many pitfalls of food on that first date. This article was by Uzma Mia.
And this is from the Herald Arts and Entertainment section. Great Accolade and Unforgiven Troubles by Victoria Brennan. The heroes on the COVID front line and the ongoing fight against the virus were the issues discussed by columnists and contributors in the newspapers. The Daily Mail. Robert Hardman said the Queen's award of the George Cross to the NHS was the greatest accolade a grateful nation can bestow beyond the field of battle. There is no decoration, military or civilian, comparable to the GC, other than the Victoria Cross, which can only be won in the presence of the enemy, he said. It is also particularly striking that this award has been made in the Queen's own handwriting, just as her father wrote the award of the GC to Malta in his own hand back in 1942. We don't often see the Queen writing out palace statements herself. This is personal as well as official. He said day after day, thousands of NHS staff came into work doing their duty in the face of a potentially lethal virus while the rest of the country stayed at home. The Queen was careful to note that the award reflects the work of the NHS across 7 decades, but especially in recent times, he said. She also made it plain that it honours all disciplines and all 4 nations. Healthcare may be devolved, valour is not. The Independent. Sean O'Grady said Boris Johnson was declaring surrender in the face of COVID. "We're just shrugging and moving on because the Tories are bored with it now," he said. "The young are being told to achieve herd immunity through mass sickness. It's grabbing defeat from the jaws of victory. It is as if Winston Churchill decided to pack it in just after the D-Day landings because, you know, people are fed up with the rationing and doodlebugs and they want the old days back." He said zero COVID may now be beyond reach, but the aim of policy should be to protect life and health to the maximum degree. "The pandemic isn't going to end on the 19th of July, and neither will the deaths from COVID, and neither will the government's troubles. They should never be forgiven." The Guardian. Eleanor Semino, Professor of Linguistics and Verbal Art at Lancaster University, said research had shown that metaverses we are exposed to affect how we think and feel about problems and their solutions. On the 17th of March 2020, Boris Johnson described coronavirus as an enemy that can be deadly but was also beatable, and hinted at the resources and sacrifices that would be needed to win the fight. She said war metaphors have long been known to be effective at persuading people that a problem is serious and urgent enough to require collective effort and a change in behaviour. Metaphors are inescapable. Used sensitively and appropriately, they can help individuals and societies overcome overwhelming long-term problems such as a global pandemic. And this is from the Herald Arts and Entertainment section. Outlander star Sam Heughan launches Royal Conservatoire of Scotland scholarship by Deborah Anderson. He found worldwide fame playing Highlander Jamie Fraser in the cult series Outlander and has gone on to become an author, producer and philanthropist. Graduating from the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland in 2003, Sam Heughan has enjoyed global success on the back of the popular historical drama series filmed on home soil and based on the Diana Gabaldon books. However, now the Outlander star is giving something back and has created a new scholarship and scriptwriting competition to support the next generation at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. Heughan is paving the way for aspiring artists to follow in his footsteps and is personally funding a new 10-year scholarship programme in his name and returning to his RCS roots to support the next generation as they pursue their dreams. The star, who graduated from the BA acting degree course in 2003, has invested in three annual scholarships for undergraduate students in the School of Drama, Dance, Production and Film. The scholarships will be awarded for the new academic year in September to two Scottish students who are taking up places on the BA acting programme and a non-Scottish student on any course within the School of Drama, Dance, Production and Film. The scholarships will support students for whom it might not have been possible to study in Glasgow at the RCS, one of the world's top three destinations to study the performing and production arts, according to World University Rankings 2021. In addition to the scholarship programme, the Sam Heughan Scriptwriting Award will be introduced later this year to encourage emerging artists to collaborate and expand their creative skills across the conservatoire's disciplines of music, drama, dance, production, film and education. Born in Balmaclellan in Dumfries and Galloway, the 41-year-old found fame playing the leading character of Jamie Fraser in smash hit time-travelling drama series Outlander. Season 6 wrapped in June and is due to air in early 2022. "I learned so much at the conservatoire, the sport that they gave me and even now the community that they've built," he said. "It felt really important to be able to give back, to help inspire some of the students and support them because I know there's so much creativity and talent coming out of this very special building." Professor Geoffrey Sharkey, Principal of the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland, said the scholarship was a generous gift. Professor Sharkey said Sam Heughan is an inspiration. Not only is he known and loved by millions around the world, thanks to his role in Outlander, but he is also passionately committed to his charitable work, in which he's made such an extraordinary difference to the lives of others. Sam firmly believes in giving back, in sharing the opportunities that he experienced studying at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. "We are aligned in our mission to make the arts accessible for all, to ensure that everyone can realise their full potential and flourish in their chosen path, irrespective of financial circumstances or other barriers they may face." It was announced earlier this month that Heughan will star in the adventure epic Everest with Ewan McGregor and Mark Strong, inspired by Geoffrey Archer's novel Paths of Glory. Set in 1921, the film centres on the real-life story of George Mallory, who's picked by Arthur Hinks of the Royal Geographic Society to scale the previously unconquerable Mount Everest. Ewan will play George Finch, Mallory's nemesis, who, despite being an outsider amongst his fellow climbers, shares their obsession with conquering Everest. It isn't just Outlander that has TV fans hooked, as he's joined forces with series co-star Graham McTavish to create Executive Produce and star in the 8-part travel show Men in Kilts, where they entertain viewers with their exploits on a road trip around Scotland. The duo travelled around the country in a camper van for a real-life adventure based on their number one New York Times best-selling book, Clanlands, Whiskey, Warfare and a Scottish Adventure like no other. Away from the entertainment world, Sam's love of a dram and his homeland inspired the launch of his award-winning whisky brand, the Sassenach. A driving force in Sam's life is his commitment to charity, and he is the founder of the global movement My Peak Challenge, which he launched in 2015. It's dedicated to educating and inspiring its thousands of members around the globe to live healthier, happier and more balanced lives while fundraising to change lives. It's raised more than $5 million for its charity partners to date. And that was from the Herald Arts and Entertainment section. And that was this week's The Herald podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes with the publisher's kind permission. Thanks for listening.